Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Oh, this young man is a sensation! Dele Alli, out of League One, into the Premier League! Oh, what a goal! It's Dele Rosalie's Premier League debut!
Got it lost under his feet, and it's cut for Lamella!
Welcome back to a jam-packed Wheeler Dealer Radio. We have been away for a few weeks due to life and laziness getting in the way. We are back, and we have a lot to talk about. Fortunately, everyone's here, despite some rather annoying technical difficulties. I want to thank Michael for helping us overcome my shitty computer at home. So let's start off with him. Michael, our resident evil numbers wizard, how are you doing on this wonderful Monday evening?
I'm good. I am, monitoring closely the end of the Republic. It's been a good couple hundred years, except for all of the slavery and all the other bad things, but still kind of sad that it's happening.
Who knew the fate of democracy was so intimately tied with that of White Hart Lane?
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
I know, right? I think I'm going to write a real good thought piece about this. Maybe I'll start and end it with a Bill Nicholson quote. I don't know. It is his first blog piece, so I feel like I'm contractually obligated to do so. Next up, we have the old man in the podcast. It's Brian. Brian, how are you doing? It's been so long. I missed you.
I missed you, too.
So we're already starting with lies on this podcast, then.
I mean, you were talking about the fall of the Republic, so I thought we would just keep going.
Well, I think that we'll keep talking about the fall of the Republic after we talk about MeUndies, but we'll get there eventually. Brian, are you all Spursed out, or are you ready to talk some soccer?
I don't know, man. I'm like emotionally drained after Sunday. Like it was. I mean, first of all, I had to suffer through a Mourinho B team soccer match, and then I had to watch the last moments of White Hart Lane. So it was like it was a very trying day.
Well, we will talk about that in much more detail in a moment, but we have to get to last and least. It's Ben Daniels, our sidekick. Ben, do you feel guilty that White Hart Lane got torn down right after you went there?
I mean, I do feel a little responsible, but White Hart Lane peaked when I was there against Bournemouth, so there was no reason to keep it going.
That's fair. That's a very humble point you've made. So let's talk about this. There was a game on Sunday, but frankly, that felt, thanks to Jose Mourinho's lineup, that didn't feel as important as all the festivities surrounding it. It was the last game at White Hart Lane, the last time Tottenham will kick a ball there, at least in that stadium. And it was a pretty, I don't know, it was for someone who's only been there to about three games there, it was a pretty emotional experience for me. I can only imagine what it was like for all the people who go there week in and week out and have been doing so for decades. But it was I thought it was a pretty great tribute, both from the fans and the club. Ben, you only went the one time, but you've been a Spurs fan for years. I mean, what did you think of the send-off we saw from the you can start with the fans, you can do the performance on the field, or you can do the ceremonies after the game. I mean, what did you think of sort of what we saw on Sunday to send off White Hart Lane in style?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the festivities were really nice. I think you're right that the match didn't really do it justice. If we had had the North London Derby win be the last match at White Hart Lane, I think that would have added a level of grandeur that I think was fitting the occasion that Jose fucking Mourinho did not provide.
I'm torn on that because I think I talked to someone about how that might have been better, but I was so, like Brian said at the beginning, I was so emotionally exhausted by the end of the ceremonies, and that was after what was a fairly comfortable win. Like, I don't know what I would have been like if, say, we beat Arsenal that day, or this had been a key game in the title race. I mean, obviously it's good to have good things happen, but shit.
It definitely would have been exhausting. It would have put you through the emotional ringer. But that feels like appropriate and necessary, in a way that Twan Zebe at right back just can't really provide. But yeah, it was. I don't know. I didn't really get to absorb it as much as I would have liked. We were doing Mother's Day festivities during the game. So I'm sitting there in my Harry Kane jersey on the couch trying to explain to my parents what a Hotspur is while all of this is happening. And yeah, so that took a little bit away from the magic of the moment. But you know, having all of the old players there, you know, printed out onto the pitch like that, even if Eric Lamela was a glaring absence from the lineup of Spurs' greatest players in history, it was still special to see those guys come back. You know, even guys like, you know, Glenn Hoddle, who's had like a pretty fraught relationship with the club.
Well, not Hoddle, but like guys like Carr were there. That was great. I loved it, but that was a weird collection of players. Like, there were a couple guys there where it was like Stephen Carr, really?
Yeah, Stephen Carr was a great right back when we could expect very little from this team. He scored that one goal.
No, I thought the whole ceremonies at the end, I thought the choir was a nice touch. I thought having the band play, that marching band or whatever, play different songs while they introduce those players. Like, you could hear, you know, as the Spurs go marching in, I think they played Can't Smile Without You at one point. I mean, it was all a nice touch. I did not know Kenneth Branagh was a Spurs fan. But I thought, Brian, I don't know what you thought, but I thought the all-star of the day was really the fans who were just, especially for the first 20 minutes of the match, were just like, I mean, you could feel the energy in there. I don't know what you could hear in England. I know on the American broadcast, you could barely hear Arlo White or Lee Dixon talking over the game, which was great. And if we could get enough noise at the new White Hart Lane so I don't have to hear Lee Dixon commentate on a match, that would be really fantastic. So I hope we can keep that up. But the fans, I thought, they were fantastic. And aside from a small pocket of fans trying the Judas song, there's nothing really ugly I thought about the day. Even the pitch invasion was kind of fun and appropriate. What did you think, Brian?
I mean, I think you're wrong. The clear all-star of the day was Dimitar Berbatov.
As always. The...
I mean, let's take that back, because I think there's maybe three contenders for all-star of the day. Ginola, no tie, looking like a badass, and Teddy Sheringham in his fucking white suit.
Teddy Sheringham was best dressed. Berbatov
a run for his money.
Ginola recording himself at the same time, too.
Ginola is so genuinely egotistical. It's charming. It's a weird line to walk, but it is very charming.
No, it's Berbatov, not the fans. The fans are fine, but it's Berbatov. but honestly, though, I think not enough credit is going to go to Victor Wanyama for, like, setting the tone for the day. I think if we'd have had to suffer through a Mourinho 0-0 up until like 60 or 70 minutes, and then, you know, kind of sit on the edge of our seats and wonder if we were going to go out with either like a loss or a draw in our last ever match, like getting a goal inside the first few minutes of the game and then basically kind of coasting the rest of the way against United.
Yeah, there were about 20 minutes where it got a little hairy, but not like,
but even then
it was at
like 2-1 when it was hairy, or 2-0 or 2-1 when it was hairy. So it was just like, I was fully prepared for, you know, Spurs to get Mourinho'd in this match. And then even with them playing their B team. And then when we got an early goal, I think that really kind of set the tone, and it allowed all the fans to not stress about the result of the game and then to kind of just begin to enjoy the experience and to really get involved with the send-off. And I think that was a huge contribution to the atmosphere that you talked about there that we had in the first 20 minutes, half hour of the match.
You're right. I think, I mean, we're not, this people on this podcast, Michael and Ben, are not always the biggest Victor Wanyama fans, but it must be said that was a hell of a goal. I love a good bullet header, and he really put that thing in the back of the net. And it was, I don't know, I guess he did that on his first goal of the year, and he really hasn't done a whole lot of it since, which is a little disappointing.
I mean, he honestly finds himself in that position like every couple games. Like, for some reason, he's on the back post on all our corner kick routines, and he kind of wound up in that position for that goal. And it's just like, he's more likely to send that into the crowd than he is to do what he did there. But the fact that he did that on the last day at the Lane against Manchester United to put us up early, like, that was just huge.
Yeah, it really helped. Michael.
Speaking.
No, I have a very important question for Michael, though. Domaginola and Dimitar Berbatov have definitely found themselves in the same threesome completely by accident, right?
By accident.
Actually, I
quote unquote there is some accident. French
club. Okay, yeah. There's some French club, and like, oh, you played for Spurs too. I don't know. I just thought that was an important question.
Monaco, and all of a sudden.
Ben, what was your very important question?
It's not a question. It's just, you know, the one thing that ruined the day for me was having Wayne.
This ought to be good. This ought to be good. What was the one thing? The one thing. The singular. Thing that ruined the day.
The singular thing was it sucks that Wayne Rooney got the last goal ever scored at White Hart Lane.
Like, it would have been nice. It was Jan Vertonghen. Let's all be real. He got his goal of the year, and it was the most important goal of the year.
No, it would have been nice if the last goal of White Hart Lane's history had been from Harry Kane, of all people.
And what a goal from Harry. That was a pretty, like, if that, for the last goal by a Spurs player, that was a hell of a, like, you know, it wasn't like a belter or anything, but that was a really good goal.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yep. We all agree.
Very, very much in keeping with the spirit of the team that both of our goals were from set pieces. just like the Spurs faithful always dream of.
Michael, you are known for your numbers and unfeeling statistics. Were you sufficiently moved by the proceedings of the match?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was... I don't know. I felt like, what's the best way of putting this? What was moving was how much everyone cared. What was moving was sort of being part of the experience and the process. Like it wasn't like there was some. I don't know. I guess the sort of what Spurs put together managed to sort of create the conditions for everyone to have the sort of mass sentimental moment of remembering remembering Spurs, experiencing their own fandom, feeling it together. And that was really great.
It's weird how simple it is of just, you know, on the one hand, they trotted those guys out there with sort of nice one-sentence introductions, but it's amazing how cathartic that was, where everyone got to sort of recognize these people and sing songs about them and, you know, get really excited to see, you know, Berbatov and, you know, all these guys from the 60s. And it was just, you know, it was pretty great. It was, you know, even though I wasn't there for a lot of that, it was, you could feel sort of a part of it. And, you know, yeah, the emotion, I think you could see the emotion on the field. And it was, like you said, it was pretty great that how into it everybody was.
I think like what you said, you know, having all the players reaching back from like Cliff Jones from the 60s, all the way to having the youth team players out there as like an honor guard. Just having that whole history of this club laid out in one place, you know, it was a nice reminder that, you know, even though we're losing our home and we're moving somewhere new, and, you know, that it is like this club will endure and goes on and is moving on to bright futures. And, you know, just seeing that whole continuum of the experience of being a Spurs supporter through the ages, you know, all there at one moment. It just really, I don't know. It felt like you're being part of like a grand tradition in a way that you kind of don't always get in the Sky Sports age of, you know, modern football, whatever. Like, you know, it is nice to feel that echo of history, you know, throughout the stadium like we did on Sunday.
And I mean, I made that joke earlier in the show about, oh, I'll begin and end it with the same Bill Nick quotes, because lots of Spurs blogs do that. And I mean, I like to joke a lot because I feel like there is an element of Spurs fandom that sort of has this sort of like performative devotion to players and games and times before they were alive. And I don't want to say it doesn't mean anything to them, because like I am very emotionally invested in a lot of like Baltimore Orioles players that I never saw, but my dad did, and I had it passed down through me. But a lot of times it feels like a performance, you know, when certain people do it, or it gets brought up in certain ways, especially when it sort of uses like a cudgel against like where the club is today. Like, why aren't we winning things like we did in 61 or whatever? But this, like you said, Ben, it felt
very genuine and very inclusive and very, like, it was mapped out in such a way that, you know, it really did make you feel part of something and stretch it out in front of you. And it was really, really nice. And I'm not going to lie, when the, especially on social media, when the sun came out at the end of the ceremony and, you know, there's a rainbow of White Hart Lane. I mean, I think even the most cynical football fan or, you know, supporter wouldn't be sort of, I don't know, touched on some level, or at least like amazed by, you know, the storybook ending for White Hart Lane, which was pretty incredible. But it was a very, it was a great day all around, and, you know, really made you feel like you were part of something special, even if you weren't in White Hart Lane. I can only imagine, you know, how great it was if you were there on the pitch getting waved off by security guards. But are there any, Ben, is there anything in the game that really stood out? We talked about the goals and how annoying it was that Rooney was there and how annoying it was that, you know, United basically just trotted out a B team. But, I mean, I think the only thing that really sticks out to me was Kyle Walker's sort of lack of inclusion.
Yeah, that was really disappointing for me. Like, whatever his baggage with Pochettino or the club is at this moment, you know, like, he's still getting games. You know, he's played every other match since his alleged falling out. He's still part of the team. You know, he has a long history with the club. He's, I want to say, the longest-serving member of the team right now.
I think Rose hasn't beat, but doesn't he?
I think they joined at the same time, didn't they?
I don't know. So, Walker was certainly established in the team earlier than Rose was. So, I mean, you know, having a guy like that who has, you know, the most connection to the team, the most connection to the ground, the most experience in the shirt, you know, to leave him out on a day like this, I was a little put off by it. Not only because he's obviously better than Kieran Trippier, but, you know, that felt a little insulting that I don't think he really deserved. And it was nice that he managed to make like a 10-minute cameo at the end of the game. Because, you know, whatever is going on, you know, as a servant to the club, I feel like he deserved better than that.
Also, especially because Trippier was so bad.
Oh, he was terrible. Like, I'm actually glad he had a game that bad.
He got roasted by Martial so many times.
I hope Pochettino was watching that over and over, because we got to go. If Walker really is off, we got to go buy somebody.
Also, who is it? Who was it that outsprinted Davies? Was it Bailly?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he got outsprinted by a center back.
Yeah, I mean, look, he.
Bailly is to very be fair, athletic, Bailly is but, fast. Yeah,
but he's a center back. Come on.
Like I said, I will defend Davies as a fine backup option. The problem is Danny Rose like gets really hurt a lot, so maybe we want to rethink that. But I think Trippier was really that whole right back situation was really the only sort of negative element of that game for me. But that's not – I think we were talking with our very own Ed Francis, our token Englishman in the writer's room, and he said something that I thought sort of rang true. I hadn't thought about it until he said it, but I think he was right after he did say it, which for him, the sort of spiritual last game at White Hart Lane was the last North London Derby, which we played 2 weeks ago now, which shows how long we've been on hiatus. And that was maybe the strangest football game I've ever watched, in that I was expecting sort of a dogfight. I thought Arsenal would really get up for that game. And I don't know if you would want to say we rolled them, but, I mean, Ben, that was certainly, in my Spurs fan, one of the more comfortable North London derbies I've ever watched. Was that between finishing above them and just beating them so comprehensively, was that a strange game for you to watch? As your marriage ended around you, I presume?
Yeah, kind of a little ugly in the Daniel scaffold. But that's okay. We powered through. I think it's kind of reflective of you know, the kind of power shift in North London. Like, I don't think it was an accident that Arsenal wasn't there for that game. They have had a bad season, and they're trending in the wrong direction. And
but they're on a great late season run, Ben. Come on, they're winning games now.
Yeah, they might finish fifth.
I mean, they've really been done in by their expectations is the problem.
Yeah, Kaylee, because Kaylee's so wrong about them, right, Kaylee? You just have no idea. Yeah.
I mean, the reality is Arsenal hasn't stood still while everybody else has gotten better, and that's Arsenal's problem. Right, Michael?
Exactly. They've been trying so hard not to stand still that they have stood still. And that was the key thing I got wrong in my piece.
An Arsenal blog took umbrage with Kaylee's preseason analysis of Arsenal fairly recently, proving my point. I actually was having a discussion with Ben about a week ago about how surely Arsenal fans can't be delusional about where they are right now. They have to recognize they're in decline. And sure enough, along comes this Arsenal blog to prove me wrong. But so were you surprised by it, Ben, or do you just think it fits a narrative in retrospect?
I mean, I was not, you know, other than the narrative of it's a derby, it's high tensions, whatever, there's nothing about how these two teams have played over the season that gave me any concern that we weren't going to win that game. You know, you obviously can't discount that other shit, but, like, the right result happened. I mean, we walked them off the pitch, and, like, that shouldn't have surprised anyone because that's where we are. You know, we are one of the best teams in England, and Arsenal is very much not.
It didn't surprise me, but in the way that – it didn't surprise me that we won, rather, but in the way that, like, West Ham got it up for – us the following week, I just expected Arsenal to sort of dig it out a little bit more, make it a little harder for us. It was just, especially, I mean, we scored, what, twice in a minute or something like that? And I understand how that's a gut punch, but, like, I mean, God, Alexis had, like, two runs for the rest of the game that made me sort of worry about anything. It was just a completely bizarre match. I mean, Michael, when you look at that, was it surprising to you?
The thing is, the Arsenal have, I mean, they had won their previous three matches, but they had been outplayed by Borough and Leicester in two of the three.
It was with their back three, right?
This is sort of my thing. I wrote my article that the Arsene Wenger, you know, his concept, especially on the attacking side, is he wants players to improvise. He wants them to develop their own relationships and figure out how to play together. He wants that. He wants to leave that open to them to a much greater degree than most coaches do, and that's tended to work. Arsenal have finished strong with, like, the same 11 most of the last several years, and this year he's switching it up, and it's a bad fit for the way he likes to manage. And what we saw in this game was all of that falling apart. In particular, I think that Alex Oxlade, the team just didn't work. But Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who had been like, oh my God, look at this, they've discovered a wingback in him. And Spurs ran at him with Heung-min Son and an attacking fullback, and he looked completely lost. We just destroyed them down that wing again and again and again because he just was not sort of – he may have some of the skills to do it, but he clearly was not sort of prepared to be a defensive wingback in that sort of situation. We just destroyed them in that space. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I think it was coming because of the way the Arsenal went playing down the stretch. But it was so much fun to watch and, like, really not worry because they were terrible. Spurs weren't even that good. The funny thing about the game, that sort of, like, the one thing I would have been nice is if Spurs had been really good. I don't think that was in, like, the top 50% of our performances this season.
No, we didn't really get out of second gear, which is almost makes it better for me, I think.
That's fair. I mean, except obviously for Victor Wanyama.
Well, we'll talk about the Regista in a second. But I thought the weird thing, too, is, like, you're right, we didn't get out of second gear, but Czech still kept that game from getting ugly. I mean, that could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, he made the most saves in a North London derby ever, which is...
Yeah. It was nuts. But I mean, I guess I'm looking at this the wrong way. And Brian, I think you'll back me up on this. You know, on the one hand, Spurs had a comfortable victory in the last North London derby at White Hart Lane. You'd think Arsenal would get up for it. But when they are going up against, you know, just sort of the heir to Xavi, the heir to Pirlo, you know, in Victor Wanyama, just making plays and cutting defenses open all over the field, it's really kind of hard to expect more out of them, right?
I mean, yeah. Exactly what you said. I don't even remember. Didn't he play one nice pass? That's what we're talking about?
He played three nice passes, Brian.
That one pass to Harry Kane, though, was like fucking...
No, I mean, if it's the one I'm thinking of, is very nice. He did a good, very good job.
Well, we were – so I was watching it with our illustrious guest host, Vince, Michael, and the renowned Brett Rainbow. And every time Wanyama would sort of get loose in space, we would start, like, joking about, like, oh, yeah, he's going to make, like, a really, like, really great through ball right here. And then he would do it. It was the weirdest thing in the world. He had a really good game. It was probably the best game of his career. Victor Wanyama, I'm making fun of him, but he genuinely had a really good game. And it was, I mean, you know, maybe he needs to play against that garbage midfield all the time, but I'm definitely going to be paying attention next year for, you know, him spraying passes like Johan Cruyff or something, you know.
The weird thing about Wanyama is, like, he's better at spraying passes than playing a five-yard ball. Like, that's always kind of been the case, and I don't really know why it is, but...
Because greatness is more interesting than pedestrian passes, Ben. Come on.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be a water carrier recycling possession.
He saw what happened to Tom Carroll. He's like, no exactly. way, fuck that shit.
Exactly. And he's unlike, you know, all that stuff that, like, Zlatan's, like, PR agency come up with about him, like, that's actually Victor Wanyama. But he's not egotistical enough to tell everybody. He just loves spaghetti. But yes, Victor Wanyama, future of Spurs midfield. I mean, Michael, do we even really need to think? Shouldn't we be selling midfielders instead of buying them this summer because we have Victor Wanyama?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who can play as sort of a defensive midfielder, a roving destroyer, or, as we discussed, redefining the playmaker position in the same way that sort of Luka Modric was the evolutionary playmaker in his time, I think Wanyama is it now. So he's basically three players, which means we only need one midfielder to play a midfield three.
I mean, honestly, Spurs should only play with 10 men next year. You're right. I mean, you know, but you don't want to take the canvas away from the artist. So, you know, you want to give him the tools with which he can, you know, create his masterpiece. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to limit him too much. You can't only give him one color to paint with, Michael. You gotta give him a full palette. Which is why we need to take one away. I know. I could only hope. I'm only trying to match the eloquence of his play, the expertise and finesse that he shows on the football pitch. It's quite incredible. It was very funny if you were there. Trust me, everyone.
We made up a song for him.
We did make up a song for him. It was very good.
Well, you please sing it for us.
I don't know if I could sort of – I'm going to leave that for Vince, actually.
Yeah, no, when Vince is on the podcast, we'll have him sing. It's Pat Benatar's Heartbreaker. Redone to express our feelings about Victor Wanyama
as a playmaker. It's pretty great. So we're going to spend a lot of time next week talking about Spurs, but given that the power has finally shifted in North London, I want to spend just a minute on Arsenal moving forward. Are you guys concerned at all going into next season? I know that we do that fatalistic, we're all anticipating bad things will happen to Spurs next year. But do you just see more of the same happening next year? Or do you think Arsenal's in a real downward spiral here? I mean, Ben, I'll start with you because you live with an Arsenal fan. But, I mean, do you think they're in trouble? Is this the one-year blip for them? I mean, how many players are they going to sell to PSG? I mean, there's a lot of questions Arsenal have going into this summer.
I mean, you know, the big question with Arsenal is obviously Arsene Wenger, right? Either he stays or he goes. And I think both of those scenarios have a lot of problems. You know, if Wenger stays, I think there's no reason to expect anything but more of the same. You know, they've been on kind of a flat trajectory for a while the top six has gotten more competitive than ever. Spurs are good. Liverpool are good again. Man City and Chelsea are obviously good, and Man United have rebounded from the post-Ferguson hangover. And so they now have five competitors for top four, and they can't just sort of coast their way there like they had been. And so there's no reason to expect, you know, their transfer policy, Wenger's managerial philosophy to change in any meaningful way to overcome that. I mean, yeah, they might bounce lucky next year and finish top four, but, you know, without major changes, you know, there's no reason to expect them to suddenly be good again. They're certainly not going to be challenging for a title. You know, the other option is they fire Wenger and hire someone like, I mean, Tuchel, I guess, is the everyone's favorite prediction for Arsenal since he's on his way out at Dortmund. But, you know,
you
I mean,
think that's going to happen? A guy who's had problems with the board at Dortmund? And I mean, we know part of the reason Wenger hasn't left is because the board is really comfortable with
him. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. The point is that, you know, Conte aside, every good manager in this top six fight who's come into the league has struggled for a year before figuring it out. I mean, Klopp is still not really there. You know, Pep, I think, was a little surprised. We all remember Pochettino's first season at Spurs. You know, it's going to be a learning curve. So at least next year, you know, it's hard to imagine whoever they get pulling a Conte and just running the league. You know, they're probably going to have growing pains. It's probably going to be a problem. So the immediate short term is, yeah, Arsenal is in trouble and has a lot of work to do. I mean, their squad is incredibly old. You know, their fringe players don't really have any resale value. They need to overhaul a lot. It's only the midfield, you know, they have a lot of guys that they're going to have to replace. Sanchez and Ozil are probably gone. You know, there's a lot of work there that needs to be done. So, yeah, I think Arsenal's screwed.
Yeah, there isn't like an obvious fix to this team like with Chelsea where, you know, they made a couple good purchases, but most importantly, Eden Hazard stopped being bad and started being one of the best players in the league again. Like, there isn't like a obvious sort of like player decline weird things that have happened to this team. There are much larger structural things. While I'm not worried about Arsenal, though, the other four teams are very good and are going to be very good next year.
There's an element to that of you're absolutely right, and I'm scared of all of them in the way I was scared of them in the preseason. But let's put Chelsea aside because they're obviously as good as advertised, at least right now. But I don't know, like Klopp's and more Klopp and Guardiola, but both of their failure to sort of kick on this year. I know it's probably or really get more traction in the Premier League. I know it's probably just growing pains with Klopp and probably with Guardiola and to a lesser extent Klopp and bad luck for both. But I'm still afraid of them, but I'm not quite as afraid of them as I used to be just because Klopp not figuring it out by now is still a little perplexing to me, even though I'm sure with a summer of Champions League money, they'll do a lot of damage on the transfer market and be much scarier next year. But I don't know. I expected more from season.
I don't see anything wrong with their season at all.
You didn't expect more out of that? I mean, I'm not talking about the way they just played, but the team they constructed and then the way they played.
They're going to end up 76 points.
I guess. I don't know. I guess their real decline really came with a bunch of injuries towards the end of the year, but still, I don't know. I expect them just to be more.
There are flaws in that team, but like, I don't think there's a single Liverpool fan who would have said if we end up with 76 points, we're going to have had a poor year.
All right. Well, think about Liverpool fans. Now think about that again. Are you sure?
I don't think there's a single Liverpool fan who is moderately reasonable.
Okay,
there
we go.
Perfectly happy with this season from the beginning of the
year. I think you could have ended that sentence if you were.
Yeah, I also don't think there's a Liverpool fan who's moderately reasonable. But yeah, I mean, you look at Liverpool, you look at City, and it's like, okay, there are clear position upgrades that they can make to make their teams better. The broad philosophy is workable. The good players they have are very good. They're not going to lose anybody.
They've got the general idea right. Even United has the general idea right.
Right.
It's just, you know, bad luck, and they probably need to, you know, figure their stuff out a little bit more. But, you know, yeah.
Arguably one of the best players in the league in Alexis Sanchez. Like, he's almost certainly gone. You know, that's tough to come back from. In addition to all the other rebuilding they have to do, plus the managerial situation, like, it's a lot for one summer. Especially a club as thrifty as Arsenal has been in the market. You know.
Well, and given that it seems like Real Madrid's like cast-offs are going to other clubs this year, it doesn't look like Arsenal's going to get James, or, you know, it looks like Isco's not going anywhere. So I don't know where they're going to buy their improvements from, especially if Alexis leaves.
Oh, they'll finally get Benzema. This is their year.
as his plane turns around halfway to London. Monaco wants to pay you money, Kareem. Okay. So, yeah, I guess the unpleasant thing we missed that we haven't talked about yet is, you know, we finished above Arsenal. Actually, Ben, let's get some reports from the front line before we move on. Is everything good on the home front now? Was it war on the day of?
Yeah, I mean, I was an asshole.
No.
My wife is the person that I am. You know, she's like, I've never said shit. Every year we finished above you and had a better season than you. So, you know, I should be able to expect that same courtesy and decency. And I said, nah. yeah, her brother was very angry, sent a lot of text messages about, like, don't say a fucking word. You know, this is, don't get used to it. You know, all that shit.
Is he new? Is he new here? Is that what's going on?
He must be. But yeah, things are fine. We're still married.
She discovered, like, the league table that you spray painted on the ceiling above your bed yet, or has that remained undiscovered yet?
Yeah, she'll find it.
Okay, that's good. So we have one more big thing that happened while we were gone, and it's the least happy thing that we have to talk about, which is we lost 1-0 to West Ham, which effectively killed our title hopes, which probably weren't going anywhere with the way Chelsea's playing right now. But still, that's what really ended our title challenge. And that was a really irritating game. I mean, Brian, was that – I don't know. My thought – Ben and I were yelling at that game together, more so Ben than me, but – It felt like that was a game where we did not play well all game. We had our chances to put West Ham on the back foot in the first half, but it felt like it really fell apart to me in the second half. Did you think we were ever in it, or was it just we didn't show up that – or did we have a chance in the first half, or did we just not show up that day?
It was just so ugly. Like, it wasn't fun or good football – from either side. I don't know if it was a question of not showing up, because that certainly doesn't feel like a thing that this team has done much in the last 2 years. But I don't know if it was just like a rare confluence of off days for everybody or what, but it just nothing ever happened. Like, literally nothing happened, I feel like, in that game. And I don't know. I don't want to, you know, I certainly don't think that it was a bottle job or that we just gave up or anything like that. I think it was just weird. I think that match was just all around really, really weird.
I mean, Ben, was that more us, them? I mean, did we not show up? Did West Ham really get it in them? Was it just not enough rest? I mean, I think it's just, especially in a derby, sometimes these games happen, and it sucks that it happened when it did, but this is what happens when you don't have the depth of a Chelsea or you can't rotate in some of those guys. But it was not fun to watch. I know that much.
Yeah, I've kind of, you know, blocked this out of my memory. I can't give you any, like, real robust analysis here. It just – it didn't feel like – I don't know. Yeah, it didn't feel like we were at our best. We didn't seem sharp. You know, a lot of players had mediocre days. West Ham scored a dumb goal. Like,
as soon as Adrian was able to get his leg in the way of that Harry Kane shot, like, after that, it all just felt like not our day. And I don't know. We're clear bottlers, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the only way to put it. I don't know. I just remember being very angry and yelling at the TV. And also, Judas over here, I watched the game with Greg, and he was texting my wife about, man, I can't imagine how you deal with this every Spurs match, the way Ben screams in the television. What a lunatic. I'm sorry for you. So this fucking collaborator over here.
It's all complicated here in Spurs land. It's all very complicated. Michael, yeah. We're bottlers, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, many of this team's worst performances have come in a 4-2-3-1 formation that doesn't really make sense. which is the Dyer Wanyama double pivot. You know, we got stomped by Liverpool. It ended up 1-1, but we were super lucky it did in that formation. You know, this is so it's not like. I think there's something to the derby thing, and that this was a much, much better West Ham team than showed up against Liverpool this last weekend. But
Yes.
But I also think that, like, there are tactical problems with that setup that, it wouldn't necessarily have been that bad, but we have not seen that team play particularly well. I think that, like, it's kind of funny saying that because we, beat Arsenal. And we beat United, but both Arsenal and United didn't show up, and Arsenal had way bigger problems than we did. So it was frustrating to me very much at the time because like it was just like predictable watching that group not show up the way they should, watching those players not play up to the level that we'd expect because there are fundamental things that happen. We don't get ball progression out of midfield in the 4-2-3-1 that are bad. In the end, it's, Chelsea won all their games, so it wouldn't have mattered at all. So, and we beat United and we crushed Arsenal in North London Derby. So, and we're finishing second. So it's pretty good. But that was annoying at the time because it felt very predictable going in.
I think this is going to sound weird. I would have been much more annoyed with that game if Chelsea had lost on the weekend.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Even though that would have kept a theoretical title challenge alive, but. This Chelsea team is just very consistent and very annoying, and I hate them because they're Chelsea and they're bad. Even though this is probably like the least despicable version of Chelsea, which is still pretty despicable, but the way they rolled up points, it was just, I don't know. I was never feeling great about our title challenge this late in the year, but seeing it fizzle to West, it had to be West Ham too. We couldn't have just lost to Bournemouth or some stupid team like that. Ugh, I hate West Ham so much.
I was at Bournemouth. I didn't want to lose that game.
Well, then, maybe you should think about that next time.
I know. It's my fault.
But I think it's a lot of people in the media have been painting this season as some sort of failure on Spurs' part because, we lost a stupid game to a team we shouldn't have lost. What did we win? Like 9 games in a row before that? That's, I don't know. I think it's what we did this year was very impressive and. You know, the fact that it took, like, maybe the best Chelsea team since, like, early Mourinho to really beat us for the title is, I think that's something we should be proud of. Not, why can't Tottenham win the title? Like, well, maybe if we spent a couple, maybe we were able to spend, like, 90 million more on our squad, we'd be able to win the title. But the fact that we've done as much as we have with the resources we've had in comparison to our competitors is very impressive. So I want to talk about just a little bit about us moving forward. Michael, you've said a lot about in various on your social media and when we've talked that you think Spurs' title window is coming to an end, right? So that's 2 years in a row. We've basically been the runners-up in the Premier League in spirit, if not in actuality, last year and in both this year. But, that's 2 years in a row. Next year, we're going to Wembley. I'm a little worried about regression for our home record. I'm sure Wembley's going to play some role in that, but I think it's just going to be more what we did this year is not super sustainable. I don't know. I mean,
we had basically no home field advantage last year, so it's sort of,
it all works itself out. So what do you think? I mean, is Spurs window still open? How long do you think it's open? I mean, we're going to talk more about transfers and stuff next week, but just in terms of how we should be perceiving this team going forward. Because, I mean, tell me a few years ago Spurs are going to be runners-up to the title for 2 consecutive seasons, and I'd have, asked what asylum you just came out of. But, that's 2 years in a row now. It's pretty great.
Yeah. What I'd say about this is not like I'm saying if we don't win a title next year, everything is a failure. This has been great. It's been really, really good to be a Spurs fan the last few years, and we should be, we've got great players to watch. They work together. We've played lots of exciting competitive matches. I would love to see this team do a little bit more in the Champions League next year. Those are the sorts of things. Like, I'm not saying that like we need to win a title, but it is hard for me to see. I mean, there's sort of two sides to this. It's if we don't start paying a lot more in wages pretty quickly, it's very hard for me to see us keeping all the pieces of this team together. You know, Toby Alderweireld is old enough to start looking for a paycheck. Christian Eriksen is good enough to play for absolutely anyone in the world. Dele Alli is definitely going to leave us. You know, there's a question of when you want to sell on someone like Kyle Walker, who you're starting to run out of opportunities to get money for him. So the key parts of this team are unlikely to stay unless we really start ratcheting up the wages a lot more quickly than we have been recently, which means that next year, when I think we're almost certainly going to have the core of this team still together, is the year to really commit to that run. It's, you know, Spurs are clearly at about the same level. At the very least, we're at about the same level as everyone else in the Premier League, as the best teams in the Premier League right now. I think it's unlikely that going into next season we'll just say the same thing. I think it's unlikely at this point, thinking about the season starts in 2018, 2019, that we'll be saying the same thing. So this is the year to make a push to keep this team together, buy a star, buy the depth that we need at key positions. I hope it happens. I mean, it's also possible. You could argue, you know, we're going to be getting a huge revenue boost from the new stadium as it comes in. There's a very reasonable case for running a deficit for a couple of years to sort of keep things together and bridge into a period where we do have the economic power to sort of pay these players and compete at this level without having a little bit of luck and having sort of Mauricio Pochettino mind controlling them into staying. So maybe we keep this team together longer. That'd be nice. But I don't think it's the most likely outcome.
I was much more confident about us holding the team together for longer before all the stuff with Walker happened. And it doesn't sound like it's all over money, but it certainly sounds like that's at a bare minimum a component of it, if not the actual reason, and everything else is an excuse. But that is certainly the first crack in the wall here. He's the first player who's made noises about wanting to leave under Pochettino that we're not entirely fine with letting go. So I think you're right. It's going to start to become a lot trickier to hold on to these guys. And hopefully Pochettino's Argentinian mind control drugs are very strong and potent, because we're going to need them. But yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more about what our transfer window is going to look like, what we'd like it to look like next week. But I guess one last thing, and Brian, I think you're the best person to ask about this. How do you feel about playing at Wembley next year? A lot of people are drawing parallels to when Arsenal played a bunch of years at the Champions League at Wembley and it didn't go so great. I tend to think that, you know, we're going to be playing there all year, so that sort of thing isn't going to be as much of an issue, or what we saw this year isn't going to be as much of an issue, because we're going to get super used to that place pretty quick. But I don't know. It's bigger than we're used to. I mean, what do you think? Do you think Wembley's going to be a significant problem for us next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be horrible. We'll lose like two of our first three matches at home, and everybody will be voting to burn Wembley to the ground. And then things will largely be fine after that. I mean, I think kind of best case scenario for us is we have a season like 15-16 where, you know, like Michael said, we basically didn't have any home field advantage. You know, if we can pack
a lot of Spurs fans in there.
I mean, look, if we can pack it with 80,000-90,000 people every week, I mean, that's a massive achievement for the club, one. But two, it's just such a big pitch, and it is I don't know. It's going to be a big ask. I saw us play at Wembley this year, and we looked largely fine, but you know, our record at Wembley this year kind of speaks for itself.
I was about to say, what was the result of that game?
Yeah, we drew. But
again,
we got knocked out of the Europa League. So, I mean, I think it will be largely fine. But again, I think that there will be at some point, particularly early in the season, if the team is kind of unsettled at the beginning of the year, where we will lose a couple home matches in a row and people will start to collectively lose their shit. But by the end of the year, it'll probably have wound up being a non-factor.
Well, here is hoping.
I think the problem is we're looking at it the wrong way. You know, this season, it was our last season at White Hart Lane, and we turned it into a fortress, and everyone was there for it, and We didn't lose a game all year. We had a big blowout celebration to send it off. You know, next year is our last year ever playing at Wembley. And I think we need to treat it with that same mentality. It is. Well,
hopefully,
our
we play at Wembley again. I mean, you know, there's.
I hope they do a big ceremony at the end of the year. Wembley, the finale.
The finale.
They bring out all the players who are Spurs legends at Wembley.
Yeah, I mean, this is a historic, you know, venue for this club.
They'll have the current team out there. They'll bring back Moussa Sissoko from Lyon.
Exactly. You know, I think we just need to treat it with that mentality, that this is, we must protect this house. This is our last year ever playing.
We're not Under Armour next year, Ben. We're not Under Armour next year, Ben. Come on. We've got to come up with a new slogan.
No. Anything to distance ourselves from Nike and their horrible kids.
I mean, really,
we're
going to
have some bad jerseys next year.
Our approach has to be to just do it, honestly.
Oh, all right. Good one. Brian, I appreciate your commitment to brands. That is going to be very useful with MeUndies in a few weeks. So yeah, let's get to some questions from our loyal listeners. We'll start with a good question for once. This will come from our good friend Violence, who is at Phil Ken Sabin on Twitter. He wants to know if you could have one piece of White Hart Lane. Ben, we'll start with you on this. To keep his memorabilia, what would it be? And Christian Eriksen is not a valid answer.
Oh, then pass.
You're just gonna pass on it?
No, I mean, you know, obviously, like the golden cockerel would be super awesome to take home, but I think we have plans for that one. I think I would want to take home the giant post that obstructs your view of the goal. That really is what gave me the fondest memories. In the first half of the game I went to, it was right between me and our first two goals against Bournemouth, and I barely saw both of them. So I think that is what I will treasure from my experience at White Hart Lane.
That is something you could probably – I'm sure Alani would be happy for you to put that in the house somewhere. Brian, what would you take home from White Hart Lane? What would you put in your house from White Hart Lane?
I think I'd just want Pochettino's chair. I mean, if you – you
looks
know,
like a really comfy chair.
It's really comfy. It's heated, air-conditioned. I mean, I think that would be really improve my Spurs match watching experience if I were to add that to my living room. And, you know, you just think about all the other wonderful assets that have been in that chair. You've got Andre Villas-Boas, and really that's it, I guess, just him. but other than that, I mean, you can just think about that.
I would want that gate that ABB couldn't open during the Europa League game. That he kept like fighting with and fidgeting with and ended up slamming. I would want that somewhere in my house just so I can remember AVB as he truly was, trying to do something and not really being able to execute it. Michael, what piece of memorabilia would you want in your house?
Yeah, I mean, I assume there are, you know, areas of the locker room that haven't been.
God.
What? Where do you think I'm going with this?
I think you're going with like where Dele Alli and like Eric Dyer, like.
Look, that's exclusively
their love. Yes,
that exclusively happens at the training ground. Come on,
White Hart Kaylee walking around like the dilapidated like training or like locker room before they shut it down with like a black light, being like, "Where was it?"
Yeah.
So, what were you saying before I really interrupted
you?
You've
all achieved my bit for me. I just need to set you guys up, and it would roll out from there. Didn't even need to do the work.
You know, this podcast is a really we're a lot like Tottenham's press. We're when it comes to bits, we all, you know, it's all well-oiled machine. We all get it.
Right. The pressing trigger happens, and we just jump on it.
It's like Eric, a joke about Eric Dyer and Dele Alli fucking. Oh, we got it.
I assume that's what they call the pressing trigger too.
Exactly.
They were so cute at the celebration too, holding hands.
Oh my god, it was so
they have rainbow and
oh man, I almost don't want to move on from this bit, but we have another important bit to develop, which comes from Vince, our the official songsmith of Wheeler Dealer Radio. He wants to know, Michael, I think this is a good question for you. What does Paul Pogba have to learn from Victor Wanyama specifically?
What can Paul Pogba learn from the finest midfielder of his generation?
Right, because, I mean, what everyone talks about Paul Pogba as the sort of evolutionary midfielder who can, like, who can create from deep and make the runs that he does and play a defensive role. But it seems pretty clear at this point that he's been surpassed by the Regista. And at this point, I think that, like, it would make sense for him to beg for a transfer to Spurs just to watch Wanyama play while he rides the bench for at least.
It's like how, to prepare for a movie role, Daniel Day-Lewis went to Italy for a year to be a cobbler, and he studied with, like, some old Italian cobbler in the mountains or whatever. And, like, really, that's what he should do. He should come to Spurs with Victor Wanyama, and Victor can teach him the ways of the midfield by helping him hand make artisanal spaghetti. I think that's what Paul Pogba needs to do. That's how he will become a better midfielder.
Seems right.
Ben, do you have any thoughts on this?
Nope. This is no.
Brian, you have anything to add?
Nope.
No, nothing about you want to work Dele Alli and Eric Dyer's relationship into this? Like, it's not too late.
That's not my bit.
Okay. Michael, do you want to work it into this bit before I move on? It's not too late. We can always – there's always room for Dele Alli and Eric Dyer bits on this podcast.
That's what they call it.
Very good. Very good.
There are bits involved, yes.
Aaron LaPlante wants to know, because – so this one requires a bit of explanation. One bit that we are developing here, which is true, so it's not really a bit, is that I think you guys will back me up on this, that there is no bigger basic bitch in the world than Harry Winks, who his Twitter opinions are incredibly basic, as demonstrated last week by his Justin Bieber hat and solid gold iPhone that he was given by some brand who I can't recall off the top of my head. He is also, Ben, I believe, could you explain a little bit about Harry Winks' choice in movies?
Yeah, it's not good. So Harry Winks...
why are you continuing talking? I just would have left it just right there. Not good.
I mean, you know, unlike Eric Dyer, who has a clear appreciation for... you know, those avant-garde, you know, cinematic movements, you know, the French New Wave and, you know, Italian neorealism, etc. Harry Winks, his opinion on films are something like White Chicks Never Gets Old, top film.
That's actually an opinion he has. We are not putting words into Harry Winks' mouth there.
Not that just is, an opinion yeah. he had, an opinion that he had and was like, this is what every single person in the world who can see this opinion needs to see.
So all this is my very roundabout way. This is what we were at. We were asked two questions by Aaron, which the first is, do the wheels finally fall off Wheeler Dealer Radio? To which the answer is absolutely. The second question is, which members of Spurs would play the White Chicks in a Tottenham remake of this movie? I mean, Ben, do you have any thoughts on this illustrious question?
I mean, I think Harry Winks would try and would be immediately pulled aside and lectured on why that was a very bad idea.
You don't think he could reach the heights of the Wayans brothers?
Yeah, he is no Sean and Marlon.
Are those actually the ones who are in the movie?
I think so.
Oh, hopefully so. I hope you're right.
I don't think Damon is in it.
Brian, which members of Spurs do you think would play the White Chicks?
I'm trying to remember the underlying premise of the White Chicks movie. I believe it's that they are cops and they are going undercover dressed as white women to do...
like a sorority, right? Or...
yeah, in a sorority.
It's some, no, drugs. It's like something like the Hamptons or at some like... some frou-frou rich white people gathering.
But they're basically cops or FBI agents.
They're cops. Yes.
They're going undercover to...
ooh, I think Ben has more time with...
they're FBI agents.
Yeah, okay, FBI agents. And they're undercover for I don't know, just trying to bust a drug ring or who knows. It's not really important. But the question is then which Spurs players would best fit into role as buddy cops? And the answer is obviously Heung-Min Son and Kevin Vimmer.
I just realized what a tremendously bad idea it was to ask you this question. Do you want to explain that anymore, or do you just want to let it go right there?
No, it's just those two as buddy cops, but them dressed as women.
Okay.
So that's it.
Is that it? Is that nothing you want to add?
That's it. No.
You going to put a bow on that?
I don't have to like tie this up into any convoluted plot knots or anything. Just leave it. Vimmer, Heung-Min Son.
Okay. Michael, do you have any? Do you want to add anything to this train wreck?
Yeah, no. You guys have. I was going to say I didn't know anything about white chicks, but now that Ben has provided a clear précis of the film, I don't really have that excuse.
So our next question comes from regular podcast question asker Haley Bachrock. She wants to know, what lengths will Jan Vertonghen go to score a goal in the next two matches? I think the lengths, similar to the lengths you would see Tom Glover go to create art, for instance. I don't know. Michael, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, if Jan Vertonghen plays fewer than 180 minutes at striker over the next two matches, it'll be a dereliction of duty and poach out.
Definitely, definitely. Brian, do you have any additional thoughts?
I mean, if we get a penalty and Vertonghen doesn't take it, it's going to be a travesty.
Poach out.
It will. We found our breaking point. We will see you in New Jersey this summer with bed sheets, Marisa. Why did you not play Vertonghen at striker? And also, can I interest you in our newsletter about Nkudu at left wing back? Ben, do you have any thoughts on the lengths to which Jan Vertonghen will go to score a goal?
I mean, Harry Kane is chasing the golden boot. And so if there's a penalty, he's going to want to take it. I think Vertonghen might actually murder Harry Kane to take that penalty.
He could just hide in Harry Kane's mouth, like leap out, take the penalty before Harry realizes what's going on.
I think even Harry Kane might notice a man living in his mouth. Maybe not.
Sure.
You don't know.
That was a man living in his
mouth. Like, we just see it to find out.
Now, finally, our last question from MVP of the podcast, A Cider Drink. He wants to know, Ben, we'll start with you on this because you always like it when I go to you first. Which current member of Tottenham Hotspur would you want to be your child counselor at summer camp as we approach summer in America and we send our children off to camp so we don't have to deal with them for a month? Which member of Tottenham would you like to be their counselor at summer camp?
I think it's going to be Eric Lamella. You know, I think a lot of what you do at summer camp is like a lot of like wilderness survival. shooting guns and bow and arrows.
Learning how to tie knots. That's very important.
I am very proud of your commitment to bits tonight, Brian. It's very good. I'm very proud of it. But Ben, continue.
Bits plural?
Yes.
bit. One. I just have the one.
I honestly wonder how many of our listeners have any idea the origin of this Heung-Min Son tying knots thing even comes from. But
really,
I'm not remember
it's
either.
Better out of context. It's really,
it's
really
much
good
better
out
of context.
So yeah.
Also, Eric Lamella, he'll teach bad habits, the kind of bad habits you expect your children to learn at summer camp, you know, like how to sharpen your elbows, how to cut your hair like that, you know, lots of really bad habits. So
yeah, I mean, you want to like a new identity, you know, when you're away at summer camp, and Eric Lamella with, you know, a pair of scissors and some eyeliner can give that to you. So he'll let you find yourself and then, you know, murder small animals and other children.
It's like, do you like The Cure and killing right backs? Because boy, do I have a guy. Yeah. Brian, you might have already answered this question, but who would you want to be your kids' counselor at summer camp? I suppose you would be talking about a camp that involves sailboats.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who lives in Florida, there is most of the summer camps it's not like traditional Midwest or Northeast summer camps. They are yachting summer camps, basically. And as you mentioned, knot tying is a very important part of sailing. And so you need a camp counselor who is two things, who is incredibly agile and who is good at tying knots. And that's Hung Min Thun.
Just bravo. That's very good work, Ryan. I'm very
Is that really what summer camp is like in Florida? Like, I want to focus on that for a minute.
No, there's yacht summer camp. There's like yachting summer camps where these fucking rich white kids just go.
What do you think Bannon Trump is doing all summer, Ben, other than avoiding his father?
Like, we don't have summer camps where you go stay in the woods, because first of all, there are no woods, and second of all, it's hot as hell down here during the summer, so why would you want to do that?
I mean, you live in a swamp and you fight a gator. I don't know.
Aren't kids in Florida who like spend their summers in the woods like members of right wing separatist groups?
Yeah, or they work in sugarcane factories. Those are the two options. So summer camp is, like I said, it's the provenance of rich white kids who they're either at tennis or yachting or some other white privilegey thing.
And we could really do without Florida.
Yeah. Sorry, Brian.
Yeah, but the weather's great.
Finally, Michael, who would you want to be your kid's counselor? Because you this is interesting, because you're the only one here who actually has a child.
Exactly. As a father of children.
The unofficial father of another child.
Exactly.
You have an important decision to make.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, what you want from a camp counselor is someone who will sort of open your child's eyes to more of the world, someone who can sort of like help them face more conundrums.
Don't open your child.
Show like greater bravery and learn more about themselves and what they can accomplish. And I think that traveling in a TARDIS with a Time Lord.
Look where he's going.
That was not where I saw this going at all.
What a pivot. What a pivot.
It's like a double pivot.
Yeah, it really was.
Wow, that would be good. Would you want to put Sam in that much danger with Christian Eriksen traveling through time in midfield?
Don't you trust him?
I would trust him. I'm not sure I'd trust him. I feel like he'd forget he had a traveling companion. But I guess he never forgets where everyone else is on the field, so maybe he would always know where Sam is.
His situational awareness is spectacular.
Well, I'm glad no one here said Tom Glover, because I don't think we've actually really explained that joke on the podcast, and we're not going to start now. But we're talking about
specifically your joke.
No, Tom Glover would be only at I don't know. Shit, what's the camp in
Carcosa?
What's the camp in the Jason movies? Camp Crystal Lake or whatever. Anyway, sure. That's where he's spending his summers. Yeah, it's a great joke. Trust us. On that note, I think it's time to wrap it all up. Ben Daniels, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Gary Rootbeer.
Brian, where can people find you on the internet?
I guess since we're doing this for real, I am on Twitter at Brian, that's Brian with a Y, THFC.
Michael Cayley, where can people find you online?
I have an Instagram account. It's real. It's at Brett Rainbow. You can find it.
And you can find my live journal and LinkedIn at Brett Rainbow. So on that note, for Ben, for Brian, for Michael, I am Brett. Come on.